On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Maryland Morning. Before the Supreme Court's historic decision in 2013 that said states could no longer ban same-sex marriage, there was Edie Windsor and a big real estate tax bill. Roberta Kaplan is the lawyer who took Edie Windsor's case to the Supreme Court, and when she won, the Defense of Marriage Act was no more. Conversation with Roberta Kaplan, who takes us behind the scenes of this historic case. Then, author Beth Baker says the baby boomers are finding all sorts of new ways to retire. She'll tell us about the many new colors of the golden years. Plus, Martin Goldsmith's grandfather and uncle tried to sail to Cuba and to America to escape the Nazis in World War II. They were turned away and eventually killed at Auschwitz. Goldsmith retraces their final journey in a poignant book, Alex's Wake. All that and the environment in focus, first, the news.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody. Welcome to Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. In the fall of 1996, Congress passed by an overwhelming margin the Defense of Marriage Act, which defined marriage in the eyes of the federal government as being between a man and a woman. DOMA, as it's known, was declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court in 2013, the same year that Maryland's Civil Marriage Protection Act became law after voters here became the first in the nation to approve same-sex marriage by referendum. Let's listen again to a conversation I had with Roberta Kaplan last month. Kaplan is the lawyer who argued the landmark Supreme Court case that overturned DOMA. She wrote a book about that experience called Then Comes Marriage, United States v. Windsor and the Defeat of DOMA, a book the Los Angeles Times has named one of the top 10 books of 2015. I asked Ms. Kaplan to take us back to 1996, when the Defense of Marriage Act was introduced in Congress by Representative Bob Barr of Georgia, and to remind us of what the law said.
It's kind of incredible when you look back on it. DOMA was very unusual law in a lot of ways. But I think one of the ways it was most unusual was the fact that when it was passed in 1996, it had absolutely no impact on anyone. And what I mean by that is what DOMA said, or what the section of DOMA that we challenged said, is that if gay people ever get a chance to get married in any state, anywhere in the country, then that marriage, for purposes of federal law, is not a marriage. It's null and void. But the incredible thing is, back in 1996, no gay people were getting married anywhere in the country. That did not happen until 2003 in Massachusetts. So it was purely a hypothetical law when it was being passed.
President Clinton signed it into law literally in the middle of the night, so no one would reputatively notice. And in this book, you interpolate your own story of your own coming out, your marriage to your wife, Rachel, your son, Jacob. And you tell a touching story about when Jacob was born, the hospital personnel would not let you carry him out of the hospital because you weren't a legal parent.
Yeah, so our son was born actually shortly before I argued the New York marriage case, which was the New York court's highest court, the Court of Appeals, that I lost. And just before that, our son was born, and we had a terrible experience where he had jaundice when he was born, and so he was under the lights in the NIC, what they call the NICU, for at least 3-4 days. And when it was finally time to take him home and we were all ready, and my wife had had a C-section, so she was still pretty sore, the hospital personnel wouldn't let me do so. They made my wife get up from bed and go get him because they said that I wasn't recognizable as a legal parent.
So the impact of this law was, and one of your arguments at the Supreme Court was that there were impacts of this law that Congress did not anticipate. We'll talk a little bit about that, but first tell us a bit about Edie Windsor and her wife, Thea Speier.
So, you know, I was so lucky to be asked by Edie to represent her in this case. And I think we as a gay community and, frankly, this country are so lucky that she ended up being the plaintiff who won this case and carried this message. The life that she lived, both before she ever met Thea and then for the 44 years that she was together with Thea, is such a testament, I think, not only to bravery and courage, but to what so many gay people had to live through for so many years in ways that I think that young people today don't even understand. So just the highlights I'll give you. Edie grew up in Philadelphia. She's not very far from you guys. Her father lost his business, and they lost their family home during the Depression. She went to Temple University, and while she was at Temple, she actually fell in love with another woman. But the idea back then of living her life as a queer, which is her word, was inconceivable. This was the 50s, and no one was living their lives openly as gay unless you were really willing to live on the margins of society. So she got married to a guy. That's how she gets the name Windsor. The marriage, needless to say, did not last very long. After a matter of months, she told her husband that he deserved to be loved the way he really deserved to be loved and that she needed something else. And like so many other people, myself, a couple decades later, she moved to New York, or three decades later, she moved to New York in order to be gay, as she put it. And then after kind of struggling in New York and becoming one of the earliest computer programmers in the country, she was at dinner one night in the Village, and a woman by the name of Thea Spire was brought over to her table. At least from Edie's perspective, it was love at first sight. According to Edie, not so for Thea. She kind of chased Thea for a couple years. But then after a couple years, they got together. And the truly amazing part of the story is what happened for the next 40 years, because Thea was diagnosed with a particularly terrible form of multiple sclerosis about 10 years into their relationship. Over time, she lost use of her legs, her arms. By the time she died, she was paralyzed. Edie has said that that diagnosis happened to both of them and that they both made sure that as little in their lives changed as possible. And we know that that's true because on the day Thea died, she actually had two patients. She was a psychologist, and she had two patients who she was supposed to see that day. Look, the one thing that I know about in life is that no one knows what life holds for you, right? We don't know. No one knows, God forbid, that you could wake up one morning and find out that day from your doctor that you have MS. But the one thing that I think we all do know is if, God forbid, that happens to any of us, we would all want to have a spouse like Edie Windsor at our side.
Ms. Windsor's case centered around the fact that she was stuck with a huge real estate bill. And you write in the book that had her name been Edie Windsor, she wouldn't have had to pay that. But because she was a woman and not legally her marriage was not legally recognized. They did, we should say, she and Thea got married in Canada in 2007. But the federal government didn't recognize that marriage. So this was a real estate case as you started winding its way through the courts until you got to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, it was like a lot of great American issues. It started out as a tax issue. You know, our country started out as a tax fight, too. So this was a fight about taxes. Edie, basically, when she inherited their estate, inherited Thea's estate, and she inherited the apartment that they had lived in and bought together, she had to pay a huge tax on Thea's half because, as you can imagine, the value of New York City real estate increased over the 30 years that they'd held it. The tax bill was $363,000. It was essentially a tax on being gay. And Edie decided that she felt indignant at having to pay that tax, and she decided to sue.
So you go through the lower courts and you win in the Second Circuit Court on an argument premised on the notion of heightened scrutiny. What does that mean?
So it's complicated. It's kind of a legal term, a lawyer's term, and I hate to kind of get into legal terminology with people. But what it essentially means is that there are certain kinds of laws that if the legislature passes a law that treats certain groups of people differently than other groups of people, black people, women, et cetera, then the courts, when they look at those laws, when they're challenged, they need to look at them pretty carefully because we assume in our society that the legislature should not be in the business of passing laws that treat black people differently or women differently or now gay people differently. So that's what heightened scrutiny is all about, and I'm very, very proud to say that we won that in the Second Circuit. And the Second Circuit said that laws that treat gay people differently are subject to that kind of heightened scrutiny.
And for a while, there's a question as to whether or not the Supreme Court would take up your case. They eventually did. The Obama administration and Eric Holder, the attorney general, decided not to defend the law. So your opposition in this case was a group formed by Congress. The acronym is BLAG, the Bipartisan Legal Advisory Group, who argued the case in support of the law on behalf of Congress. You win the case, and you do so by using a phrase, or one of the things you use as you argue it, is the notion that times can blind. So in 2013, when you win, Were you able to convince the court that things were just a whole lot different than they were in 1996?
Yeah, I mean, there was no question that they were. I don't think that was the harder part of my argument. I think they all accepted the fact that there's been this sea change, as Justice Scalia called it, a sea change in how Americans understand gay people. And gay people have always been around. It's not like Americans didn't know gay people going back to 1996. What's changed is that Americans now know that they know gay people, right?
Right.
Because so many gay people have come out of the closet. And that really is the sense I use, this language times can blind, that comes out of Justice Kennedy's decision in Lawrence in 2003, in which he held that you can't criminalize being gay. And I really do think it says what this is all about, that sometimes in our country, times can blind us to moral truths that we don't realize. And in the past, Americans didn't realize that gay people and gay couples and people like Edie and Thea had the same dignity as everyone else.
So you argued that case in 2013. At that time, there were 13 states that allowed same-sex marriage. And after the case, that number shot up to 37. And then 2 years later, in April of 2015, there was a case called Obergefell versus Hodges, in which the Supreme Court ruled that nobody, no state could ban same-sex marriage. Moving forward, of course, a lot of people, when that historic decision came down last summer, they said, well, it's still the case in a lot of places that you can be married in the morning and then go back to work and lose your job. What is the next step for the gay rights community when it comes to the law and when it comes to knocking down the remaining barriers to being treated equally?
Let me be clear. The one thing that is clear, I think, from Windsor and Obergefell is that the government can't discriminate against people because they're gay. So if you have a government job, local, state, or federal, you can't be fired anymore in this country because you're gay. But that leaves open, as you suggested, the big question, which is what about private employers? What about private businesses? And that's very much kind of a mixed map right now. There are many states like New York, that prohibit discrimination against people because they're gay. There are many other states that need to pass those laws, and their efforts underway. We could solve the whole problem if the federal government, Congress, passed that law, and there's legislation pending in Congress. But Congress, as we all know, is not exactly energetic about passing new laws today. So one other approach that's been taken is the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission actually takes the position today that if you're fired from a job because you're gay, that's sex discrimination because you're being fired based on gender stereotypes. And if that's what happened, that's already illegal because it violates Title VII of federal law.
Roberta Kaplan, she successfully argued the Supreme Court case that brought to an end the law known as DOMA, which defined marriage as being between a man and a woman. Her book is called Then Comes Marriage, United States v. Windsor and the Defeat of DOMA. We'll have more information on our website, wipr.org/Marilyn Warning. Coming up after a break for news, local author Beth Baker finds all sorts of new ways that people are living in retirement. It's Marilyn Warning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's at wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
On 88.1, it's Marilyn Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Now we're going to revisit a conversation with an author from Tacoma Park who has been studying the ways older people are coping with the challenges of living independently. Beth Baker's first book examined how nursing homes are being transformed. Her latest book looks at how people are, in many cases, avoiding institutional care completely. As she points out, in 1900, only 4% of Americans were over the age of 65. Well, in just a few years, that number will swell to 17%, and high housing costs will put nearly half of America's 72 million baby boomers at risk of busting their budgets. But living independently doesn't have to mean living alone. The book is called With a Little Help from Our Friends, Creating Community as We Grow Older. We spoke about the book last April. We talked about the fact that aging is something many of us are clearly in denial about. For example, she writes that Americans spend about $100 billion on anti-aging products. I asked Beth Baker if her book was a clarion call to end that denial.
It's definitely a clarion call, and I like to always say denial is not our friend.
Yeah.
And the more we plan for our future, the better off we're going to be. And part of that is how we live, and that's really what I focus on in the book.
And a lot of people want to live, and the term of art is aging in place.
Yes, which I also sort of push back against, because aging in place is only as good as the place you're aging in. And if that place leaves you lonely and isolated, it might not be the best place. So I prefer the notion of aging in community, however we define community.
Mm-hmm. It's simply unsustainable for 72 million of us. And I'm a baby boomer. You're a baby boomer. Those of us born between 1946 and 1964, it's unsustainable for all of us to live in our own homes for the rest of our lives, right?
Especially when we need assistance. It's really unsustainable. And one thing I really tried to do with the book is find affordable options for people. I wasn't interested in writing a book that only the 10%ers could could live out. And a lot of the options were quite affordable.
Now, the concept of retirement living, you write, came on the scene in 1955. And the irony of the fact that it was invented in a place called Youngstown, Arizona, didn't escape me. And then in 1970s, or in the 70s, we had this notion of assisted living, right? That's a $54 billion industry. Mm-hmm. So this is big bucks putting into this thing. And the assisted living model is very popular, but it's not really for everybody, either because their financial resources don't allow it or they just don't prefer it. So you're looking at all these different solutions, and we'll talk about some of them just in a second. But with all the different ways you looked at it, do they all have certain things in common?
I think they have the certain values in common. One is understanding the importance of relationship and community, not only to our mental health, but to our physical health. Everything we're learning about successful aging says loneliness is our enemy that you want to avoid. Mm-hmm. And they also, at the same time, allow people to continue to be autonomous and independent. So having those two things, the relationships and the independence, I think are the themes that go through the book and all these models.
You write about a place called The Village right over down 95 in Washington, Capitol Hill. There are 360 people living in 265 households. What is The Village model?
Village model, there's 150 already around the country and an equal number being created. And it's basically a neighbors helping neighbors membership organization. So for people that really want to stay put but are worried they might be lonely, this is a great model. And the Washington area is a real hub of these villages. And there's a couple in Baltimore and a few more being organized.
So it's sort of an organized, sort of official way. I mean, they have an executive director. They have somebody whose job it is to make sure that people are being tended to. Is this the kind of thing that people sort of used to do? People used to be neighborly just because it was the neighborly thing to do. Now it's being codified a little more?
I think that's true. And these organizations don't help people with medical care. It's things like, do you need a ride to the movies at night? Do you, anything you can think of that's non-medical, these villages can do. And they often connect people across generations, which is also really great.
You told the story of a lady who's 100 years old, and she was in the mood for pizza.
Yes.
And she couldn't finish a whole pizza by herself, so she found some people to share a pizza
with. She called The Village, and they went and got a pizza, had it for lunch, and took her a couple of slices.
Yeah, that's great. Now, you talk about a model called co-housing, and there are more than 100 of these communities that have been completed in 37 different states.
Mm-hmm.
One of the advantages is that they use about half of the amount of land that a regular subdivision would use. So what is a co-housing community?
Co-housing is probably the most ambitious model I write about. It's a true intentional community. So people come together. They usually build the community from scratch or retrofit buildings, and each has a smaller living space than we might think of, but a full space with their own kitchens and everything. And then they have very generous common spaces, big enough so if they want to have dinner once a week together, they can. it's kind of having built-in friends and neighbors. So people who live there are really wanting a strong community. They make all their own decisions. And this is one of the hallmarks also of what I write about compared to what we think of as traditional retirement communities. These are grassroots, created, led. They don't want a lot of people telling them what rules they have to obey. It's people really creating lives for themselves that they are happy with.
Beth Baker, the book is called With a Little Help from Our Friends, Creating Community as We Grow Older on 88.1. It's Marilyn Morning. I'm Tom Hall. So with a place like that, with a community like the co-housing model, is it like a fraternity and a sorority? Can they kick people out if they don't like them? Or can they refuse entrance to people?
No. It's legally like a condo.
Mm-hmm.
So people buy their, usually, sometimes they're renters. They buy a unit or they have a lease. And it's just like you would think of a condo, except the decision making is consensus, meaning they decide things together as a group until everybody can kind of live with the decision. They have meals together, as I mentioned, usually at least once a week. There's a lot of community gardens. It's just much more of a sense of community ownership. But think of it more like a condo than a fraternity.
Mm-hmm. And then there's the cooperative model, the co-op. A lot of these were begun by labor unions.
Yes. In New York City, especially the garment workers created affordable housing that was cooperatively owned. And today, there's certain parts of the nation, the Twin Cities in Minnesota, New York City, that are really into high-rise cooperatives. I also visited cooperatives of manufactured housing, what some people think of as trailer parks. And again, having the cooperative ownership gave people much more a sense of control over their destinies, and they found they actually grew closer because of that cooperative ownership.
And it makes it more affordable for many of them.
It's so much more affordable.
Mm-hmm.
Almost all, not the co-housing so much, but most of the models I write about are affordable, like house sharing is a really good example of an affordable way to live.
And you talk about house sharing, that people are sharing houses not just with their friends, but sometimes with complete strangers.
Yes, and there's a real model for this in Baltimore, St. Ambrose, a nonprofit that links older homeowners who are at risk of losing their home with younger renters, and these great bonds form across the generations, and it opens up a source of affordable housing for the younger people.
One of the most fascinating stories you tell is about a place called Hope Meadows.
Oh.
They took over, or they reconfigured an Air Force base, the Chanute Air Force Base. It's out in the Midwest. And these are this is a community of foster children that senior citizens are moving in to assist with the care of these children. Tell us about that.
This is an intentional community, and there's now several in the United States, and one is coming to Washington, actually. It's an intentional community that supports families who are adopting kids out of the foster care system. And one of the main ways they support these families is the Hope Meadows community. About two-thirds of the members are 55 and older. And so they become like bonus grandparents to these children. It is so inspiring and heartwarming. The older people get to live there for greatly reduced rent in exchange for volunteering a lot of time with the families. And one statistic, nationally, 30% of kids in the foster care system graduate from high school. 100% of these kids are graduating. And what they're creating is normalcy, permanence, love, affection across the generations. It's amazing.
Yeah, so just as the foster children get parents through this system,
mm-hmm.
they also get grandparents.
Exactly.
And they live in this place, this community that has old people and young people interacting all the time. And the people apply, the older people apply to be part of this program. And part of the application, they want to make sure that their people, you know, this altruistic bone is prevalent in the body, right? They want to make sure that their they're inclined to help.
Right. I mean, you have to sign a contract saying you'll, I forget the number of hours per week, but that you mm-hmm. will really commit to the community.
Yeah. There's one you write about a model called NORCS, the Naturally Occurring Retirement Community. So these are things that just sort of people look around and say, hey, guess what? We're retired.
We're getting old.
And here we are. So how do those work?
Well, Greenbelt has a great NORC. And these are, it's kind of like the village model. People are staying put. But in this case, instead of creating a membership organization, in Greenbelt's case, the city of Greenbelt said, you know what, we're going to support our older residents to stay here. So they created a whole raft of supportive services. The city hired 1.5 staff people. This is not a huge, costly item. And she makes sure that whatever services people need who want to remain in their own homes, that she gets for them. And again, they have a huge volunteer bank there. It's all about creating community.
Mm-hmm. There are some communities or some people who are reconfiguring homes, individual homes, to make them more accessible and easier. And this is a growing industry, isn't it?
It is a growing industry. And it's also related to a growing movement to make our cities more age-friendly. So you can't just fix up your house. It won't help you if you walk out your door and you trip on the sidewalk, or you can't get to public transportation. So it's really a very holistic development we're seeing.
You write about a doctor in Maine, a guy named Alan Teal, who is trying to sort of reimagine what it means to grow older and what it means to live in your own home. And it seems like he's having some success.
Some real success at really, truly keeping people out of nursing homes. And he's combining off-the-shelf technology, webcams, very simple technology with a core of people who said, I'll do a little bit to help this older person stay connected. And it's a very affordable way for people to stay in their own homes.
Well, Beth Baker, thanks for your time. This is a fascinating book. It's well-researched and beautifully written.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate it. It's good to talk to you. Beth Baker, the book is called With a Little Help from Our Friends, Creating Community as We Grow Older. We spoke last April. The book is published by Vanderbilt University Press. We've got a link to more information on our website. Come to WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up, a conversation with Martin Goldsmith about his latest book. Stay with us.
If I'd been out till 2:45, would you lock the door? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org, or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Welcome back on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. In 1939, the SS St. Louis left Hamburg, Germany, en route to Havana, Cuba, with more than 900 Jewish refugees on board, hoping to escape Nazi persecution. Cuba refused to accept the refugees. Neither did the United States and Canada, and the ship was forced to return to Europe. Two of the passengers on that ship, Alexander Goldschmidt and his son, Helmut Goldschmidt, are the subject of a book by Alexander's grandson, Martin Goldsmith. Martin lives in Bethesda and may be familiar to you as the host of Symphony Hall on Sirius XM Radio and the former host of NPR's Performance Today. His book is called Alex's Wake, A Voyage of Betrayal and a Journey of Remembrance. We spoke about the book in September of 2014. Introduce us to your grandfather, Alexander, and your uncle, Helmut. In 1939, they were put on this ship, but tell us a little bit about them.
Alex Goldschmidt was the son and grandson of horse dealers. He was born in the little village of Sachsenhagen in Lower Saxony in 1879. He didn't want to go into the horse business. He went into the woman's clothing business. He opened a store called the Haus der Mode, the House of Fashion, in the northwestern German city of Oldenburg. He interrupted his business life to fight on the German side, naturally, during the First World War. He was awarded the Iron Cross First Class, came back to Oldenburg, did quite well for himself, bought a splendid house next to the former Ducal Gardens in Oldenburg. And all was well until the autumn of 1932, when the Nazi Party won the elections in the state of Oldenburg, becoming the first. Oldenburg was the first state in Germany to actually elect Nazi officials. And shortly thereafter, a couple of Nazi officials came to my grandfather's house and told him that he would have to sell the house for a criminally low fee. And things went from bad to worse over the next 6 years. In the fall of 1938, he was among the thousands of German Jews who were arrested on the night known as Kristallnacht, the night of broken glass. He was sent to the concentration camp Sachsenhausen and told that he had another 6 months to leave the country or else he would be arrested and further trials would await him. So that's when he booked passage on this refugee ship heading to the New World called the St. Louis. He took along with him his younger son, my father's younger brother, Helmut, who in 1939, when the St. Louis sailed, was 17 years old. He had been kicked out of his high school, the Altes Gymnasium, but not before taking what I thought was a very heroic stand, standing up in the middle of an assembly to tell everybody who would listen that the Nazi official who was haranguing them at the time was telling nothing but lies about the deleterious effect of the Jews on the German populace. So my grandfather, 60 years old in 1939, and my uncle, 17 years old at the time, were, as you say, Tom, two of the more than 900 refugees on board this ship.
And your grandfather and uncle landed in France, and perhaps one would think that that could have been, should have been the end of it, mm-hmm. but it wasn't. They were, and it ended up being imprisoned there for 3 years until they were finally shipped to Auschwitz. Why is it that they were not allowed to become free in France?
Well, they spent two idyllic months after they arrived in France. They spent time in a little village called Martigny-les-Bains, which for many years was a famous health resort because of the healing waters. And they were part of what was called an agricultural retraining center. But then came September 1st, 1939. The Second World War broke out. France and Germany were now at war. And my grandfather and uncle, since they still bore their German passports, metamorphosed in the eyes of the French from helpless refugees to enemy aliens, since France and Germany were now at war. So they were first placed into a camp in Sion in central France. And then after the imposition or the rise to power of the Vichy government, the very right-wing anti-Semitic Vichy government, they passed a series of strictures which were essentially modeled on the infamous Nuremberg laws that Germany had passed in 1935. The so-called Statut des Juifs were published on October 3rd, 1940, and did essentially what the Nuremberg laws did. They stripped the Jews of France of their citizenship. They made it impossible for Jews to hold a number of professions, including doctors and lawyers and radio announcers. Jews had to put little yellow signs in the windows of their businesses identifying themselves as Jews. And eventually, the French began packing Jews off to the killing centers of the East, which is what happened to Alex and Helmut in 1942.
And of course, they were, as you say right in the beginning of the book, they were murdered at Auschwitz along with, countless others, 1.5 million in that camp alone by some estimates. This voyage of betrayal, the betrayal here is in a way a double entendre. And what one of the many things that is just so heart-wrenching about this book is the guilt that your father felt for not doing perhaps all he could have done to help free his father and his younger brother. And then you write very
poignantly about the guilt that you felt, having, you know, grown up comfortably in America, and you've had a great career, and you've had comfortable circumstances. Talk about what your father perhaps could have done to secure the release and get a visa for Alexander and Helmut.
He had a menial job polishing zippers in a factory that reconditioned old pants for the war effort. My mother was a domestic, taking in washing and cleaning other people's houses. They had very few means at their disposal. Occasionally, they would send $25 via the Quakers to Alex and Helmut in these French camps. But it is true that my father probably didn't do everything he possibly could have. He didn't go to Washington, D.C. and knock on the doors of every congressman trying to get every T crossed and an I dotted that he possibly could have. And naturally, he also wasn't aware of what was coming over the horizon for his father and his brother. But when the grisly newsreels arrived in 1945 with the end of the war, he was undoubtedly aware that on some level or other, he had allowed his father and brother to be murdered, in addition to his mother and his sister, who also were later murdered in the ghetto in Riga. So I'm sure he felt terribly burdened by this guilt throughout his life. In fact, he made references to it from time to time. And as you say, Tom, I am aware that on one level or another, I inherited that guilt. I, for a number of years, was conscious of the rhetorical question, how can I be happy? How do I deserve happiness when my grandfather was murdered at Auschwitz? So to a certain extent, this journey of remembrance I took with my wife was a way not only to bear witness to what had happened to them, but also I was hoping to acquire some measure of peace, some way of steering my way out of Alex's wake, this churning turbulence that I had been living in throughout my life, into a more peaceful way of existence. And I'm happy to say that by the end of the journey, I had achieved a remarkable portion of that.
Martin Goldsmith, the book is called Alex's Wake, A Voyage of Betrayal and a Journey of Remembrance. It's published by Da Capo Press. We've got a link to more information on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. That's it for us today. Coming up Friday on our New Year's Day edition of Maryland Morning, a look back at the history of the Voting Rights Act with the historian Taylor Branch and the legal scholar F. Michael Higginbotham, and recollections from people who were there about a visit to Baltimore by Coretta Scott King. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. We'll see you Friday. Thanks for being with us. Happy New Year.